Welcome to Cloud Radio, made for full-stack cloud operators. Cloud Radio covers all aspects of the business of software.
Well, I'm excited to have Guy Rubin from EBSTA. This episode came about where they had just released an excellent report benchmarking all of these dimensions of sales and the state of revenue and really unique level of depth in it. And I reached out to him and he was kind enough to join the show. Guy, do you want to tell folks more about yourself and your company?
Well, Matt, first of all, thank you for having me. Really pleased to be on the podcast and looking forward to sharing some of the insights from the 2024 B2B Benchmark Report in conjunction with Pavilion. I've done my bit there. So looking forward to sharing the insights with the community and really being blown away by the way some of the content that we've been sharing has been received.
And just, you know, at a high level, the report has covered like $54 billion of revenue, 530 companies. And I know you've done this before. Is there any other like context that's important for people listening to understand
about? Yeah, so this is the third year we've produced the B2B Benchmark Report. And every year we go deeper and analyze more data. So we analyzed 4.2 million opportunities over the last 12 months. And for the first time ever, we analyzed over a million hours of sales calls as well. So really trying to understand the difference between the way the top performers deal with objections versus the average sales reps in all of these different organizations. So real eye opener and some amazing insights and takeaways.
And one stat that really jumped out at me was 17% of reps generate 81% of revenue. Has that increased over time or like anything you want to expound upon there about that pretty extreme reliance?
It really is. We've seen the delta between the average performers and the top performers go from 4x a couple of years ago to 6x last year. At the end of last year, beginning of this year, we saw it at nearly 9x. So we're now in a position where these top performers are representing such a lion's share of our new business revenue that they can almost hold the business to ransom. And the way businesses have been dealing with this challenge in the past has been to throw money at the problem. So, you know, we'll churn the staff that aren't performing, we'll hire a load more and it'll all be fine. And of course, then they don't perform. We have to go through the same exercise again. So moving forward, businesses need to take a new tack. So we need to really get under the skin of what the top performers are doing well so that we can then replicate that across the B and C players.
Interesting. And I guess, you know, like going into it, what I really liked about the report, amongst other things, was like the breakdown in where deals progress or don't progress, where opportunities slip. And one thing that struck me was looking at kind of the difference between average performers and top performers was that so much of the loss stage for the average performers happens at the negotiation phase, whereas for the top performers, more of the loss seems to happen at the qualification and discovery phase. Is there anything more you can elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think the reality is that there's a lot of opportunities that the average performers are still leaning into and spending time on that aren't real. They were never real. It's not that they lost them. It's just that they were never in a sales process in the first place. Just because you got off a call with a prospect, you know, who might have came inbound and, you know, put their hand up and said, I'd like to know more about what you're doing, that doesn't necessarily mean that they've got a budget. There's a definitive timeline they're working to and they're the economic buyers and all the other key data points that we need to understand. And so what we see is consistently the average performers are getting off sales calls. And just because the person they spoke to was a lovely person, suddenly they think they're in a sales process. And before you know it, they're investing time and energy, not just their time and energy, but also the energy of their solution engineers, the finance team, the security team, legal and so on. When in reality, we may not actually be in a sales cycle here. And so the top performers are much more likely to, number one, self-source their own opportunities. We see more often than not they're twice as likely to find their own opportunities in market. So top performers aren't just building great relationships within the opportunities that they're working on, but they're also spending time in their geography, in their market. They're building relationships in the wider community with people that perhaps aren't even ready to enter a sales process for another 6, 9, or 12 months. And so as they build that trust with these different personas, when they're ready, they come in and all of a sudden they're now in a sales process that they've self-sourced. And then when we look at how they then deal with those opportunities and they come through, well, the top performers will close 30% of their opportunities at discovery stage because there's just no fit. the customer doesn't necessarily have a budget, or we don't know who the economic buyers are, or it's just not a high enough priority. They've got other things going on in their business that means that they're never going to get to a point where this is the P1. And so by qualifying the customers out, they can reduce the time they spend on deals that don't close one. And when we analyze that volume of opportunities, what's shocking is that only 30% of opportunities open close one. And the deals that close lost spend twice as long in pipeline as deals that close one. So there's so much efficiency in the sales process.
And that kind of seems to tie into 61% of deals are lost to indecision. And, you know, there's no great definition of that. And various people outside of EBSTA, I think I've seen it from, I believe, Gartner or Forrester a few years ago, had that closer to 40-50%. And 61% like strikes me as like incredibly high. And tying these areas together, that has to involve like some of these deals that were never actually going to happen, right?
I think that's true. I think, look, in reality, especially at the end of last year, there was a lot of deals that were pushed. Nearly half of all deals pushed last year, or certainly slipped past the predicted close date. And when we look at the data, we see that our biggest competitor is not the peers that people you're competing with in your market. The biggest competitor is the customer making no decision at all. And so we need to get better at building business cases. We need to get better at proving ROI and prioritizing what we do for the customer. This old world of, have you already got a budget for what I'm selling you? Well, the chances are, more often than not these days, there are no budgets. There is no predefined budget put aside that someone just wants to allocate to you. What we need to do is show the customer how, by working with you, the thing that you've sold for them is a priority that they should be focused on. And, you know, if you can help a business improve their growth rate from, you know, 15% to 30%, or you can reduce their costs dramatically or give them back a load of time, that's compelling. And if you can make that their number one priority, or if they can buy into that being their number one priority, then they'll find the budget to address that problem. But this idea, you know, the number of times we see opportunities closed off as lost because there was no budget. In reality, that what you mean to say is that you were unable to prove that this was a high enough priority for the customer to focus on.
Interesting. And it might be impossible for you to answer. Has there been any other factors here? Like, are there more tire kickers, if you will, kind of shopping for software, I guess, because it's fun or it fills up their calendar, or something around the idea of like these late adopters are just less likely to purchase, and maybe this should be a really concerning trend? I don't know if there are any other theories here.
We definitely saw second half of last year more pipeline being created than ever before. And I think a lot of us kind of use that safety blanket or use that pipeline as a safety blanket to assume that everything will be fine. You know, numbers are a little bit lower, but we've got so much more pipeline coming in. We're going to close it at the same rate we've always done before, and it'll all be fine. But in reality, we saw this spike in opportunities being created, but actually the impact of slippage on win rates means that win rates start dropping off dramatically once you kind of start seeing that slippage kick in. And if a deal slips by more than 50% of the average sales cycle, your win rate drops by 90%. And what we saw is all of that slippage come in. So we as sellers need to start being a lot more choosy about the businesses that we're going to invest our time and energy in going through a sales cycle. And just because someone puts their hand up and says, I want to know about what you do, it doesn't mean that they own the right to spend our most precious asset, our time. And the top performers are very good at being very ruthless, at really discovering whether that customer is real or not. And that's very different to, you know, if you're missing quota, and bear in mind that 4 out of 5 reps last year missed quota. So if you're missing quota and you've got opportunities coming inbound, it's very tempting just to keep them in your pipeline, even though they may not be real, especially if they're a really nice person. So trying to get under the skin of that and really being ruthless about our qualification methodologies is absolutely key. And I mean, it's another data point. We saw a huge adoption of different methodologies last year, whether it was Spiced or Medic or MedPick, which was probably the most popular one. And there's always all sorts of them. And we didn't actually see a material difference in the outcomes depending on which methodology you used. However, we saw lots of businesses try and adopt a methodology. And in fact, within EBSTA, there's a widget we have that sits inside Salesforce or inside HubSpot. And it automatically, you can fill it in your MedPick as you go, and it scores it as you go. What we saw consistently was that even though the reps are trained on how to use a methodology, when you go back 3 or 6 months later, it's just not consistently adopted. And once again, we fell into the trap. It's like getting the reps to manually log their activities or create contacts in Salesforce. It's not what their job is. we employ these salespeople to do something that they can't do, that the AI can't do for them, right? We employ them to build relationships, to build trust, and to close business. We can't get the AI to do that for us, okay? Especially in B2B sales, it's still relationship driven. But what we can do is use the AI to automatically log all their activity, to automatically make sure that all the contacts we're engaging with are logged in the system of record. And we've recently launched a new feature that allows the AI to take the call recordings, build the transcripts, and then pre-populate the med pick and auto-capture things like the objections the customers are raising in the call, so that when you go back to the opportunity a week or two later for the next meeting, all of those objections are outlined for you in the system of record. And it's a much more consistent approach because it's not the reps doing it themselves. And if they're busy, they don't do it very well or not do it at all. But as a manager, I can dip into every single opportunity and all of the objections are laid out in the same way. All the med pick is captured in this consistent format. Everything is scored for me, whether that's the relationships themselves or the med pick capture, so that I can see at a glance whether this opportunity is real or not and whether we've qualified it well enough to lead discovery.
That's fascinating. And, you know, we can kind of take a segue here into AI. Like, you are working in the domain of AI. Like, how has that gone? Like, any learnings? Or just maybe first just give an overview of like how AI sits within EBSTA.
Well, there's different levels of AI. So, you know, what's funny is a few years ago, we've been doing what we call machine learning, I suppose, now for a decade. And, you know, we always used to step back from calling it AI because it was never sure how people would receive it. And now, of course, it's the terminology everyone uses. So the first thing that we do for every customer, if you're trying to become a data-driven business, the first thing we need to do is fix the dirty data in your CRM. So if you're using Salesforce, like every other Salesforce environment out there, the quality of the data within the system is inconsistent. And the reason it's inconsistent is because we've relied on humans to log their activity manually or to add their contacts as they're engaging with them. And no one ever does, at least not consistently. So the first thing, we can't build the insights. We can't be data driven until we fix the data. And so before we became a revenue intelligence platform, we presented EBSTA as a relationship intelligence platform. And so the first thing we do for a customer is go through all of the historical email traffic and calendar events from the last year or two from people that perhaps don't even use Salesforce, like finance and support and service, success and the sales guys, and also people that have left the business over the last year or two. And what we try and do is trawl through that historical traffic and build this people graph of all of the relationships across the organization. And then we sync those contacts along with all of the historical activity against the opportunities that have closed both won and lost in the last 12 months. So overnight, you connect everything up on a Friday, you come in on a Monday morning, every opportunity that's closed in the past, you've now got clarity around which personas we're engaging with and how much engagement was required to achieve a certain outcome. So not only do we populate the system with all of the contacts and the activity, we also tell you who in the business holds the relationship, when did they last engage, and we build this engagement score, this number out of 100. And it's that engagement score that's our machine learning that was where we started from. And that engagement score trends up and down every day. And what it does is it tells us how much momentum we have with different personas, and that rolls up to every opportunity, which ultimately rolls up to every account. So it's just as useful for customer success teams as it is for sales teams to know which personas are we actually engaging within these opportunities or within these key accounts. Is our relationship with those key personas actually trending up, or actually do they need some attention right now? And by fixing all that historical dirty data and giving all of these relationships a score out of 100 historically, we can then go through the next step. So step one, fix the data. The second thing we do is then benchmark the data. So we try and understand the insights. So if you've been working on 1,000 opportunities over the last 12 months, you might have closed, you know, 25, 30% of those opportunities. What we want to understand is the DNA of those deals. So which personas were we engaging with at each stage of the sales cycle? How multi-threaded did we need to be to achieve a certain outcome? And then how much engagement was required? And when you start codifying relationships out of 100, it's like turning a television from being black and white onto color. Suddenly you get visibility of the fact that when our engagement is above 80, our win rates are 3 times higher. And so suddenly overnight, everyone can see what's expected of them. Build those relationships sooner with the right personas and build them stronger. And all of a sudden, consistently, you see the win rate start to increase. So now we know what good looks like. Now we understand which personas we should be engaging with and how much engagement is required to achieve a certain outcome. We can then start to use that as a benchmark against the deals that are in flight. Now we're in a place where we're delivering actionable insights and telling people what to do next or which personas to engage with or what best next action looks like inside the CRM. So all of that can be completely automated. And then we add to that things like our call AI, where we're actually automatically analyzing the transcripts of the call and pre-populating things like the med pick and identifying, stripping out things like the objections the customers are raising. And suddenly we've now got a much, much fuller picture of what's going on deals that are in flight, so that we can then either course correct if they need attention, or if required, we can close them off as lost a whole lot sooner and start working on something a lot more productive. And all of that then rolls up to our forecasting tool.
That's fascinating. And have you had any learnings on like managing expectations? Because like one of the challenges, right, with AI is you can kind of assume it might do more than it really can, or just might just approach it with the wrong standard. Like, how have you guys been like managing user expectations with like what this can do? Maybe in something like the call recording intelligence, right?
Sure. Well, look, the relationship intelligence piece, the relationship score out of 100, it's kind of machine learning. And it's not about trending to 100. Okay. You might be running a roofing company in Texas, and an engagement score of 57 is exactly all you need to win the roofing contract. But you might be running a consulting business in San Francisco, where if the relationship's under 90, you're never going to get anywhere. So your past will tell us the level of engagement you need to achieve to get to where you're going. But from a call AI perspective, it's slightly different. There, it's all about the prompts. And again, bear in mind, we've got nearly 500 companies using our platform. So understanding that the prompts required to auto populate the med pick might be slightly different for your business as it is for mine. And so you just allow the customers to evolve the prompts themselves, and you just see that they get better and stronger as you go. But the beauty is, if someone's already using a call recording tool, we're able to digest all of their historical traffic and actually do the analysis on deals that closed one in the past, and look at their discovery calls, look at all of the stages of the calls. And again, as far as I'm aware, we're the only player in the park that doesn't just analyze individual calls in their silo. We're interested in the calls and the meetings and the emails that are taking place through the entire sales cycle. So when we're analyzing things like med pick capture, we're not just doing it in the initial discovery call. You're constantly qualifying the customer throughout the whole customer life cycle. And so we're picking that up in the dozen calls that are taking place during the whole sales process. And we're bringing it together so that you've got a holistic picture as to what's actually going on that deal.
That's fascinating. And I guess, you know, one thing that hopefully is coming up in these calls or not coming up in these calls is like ROI. That was like the other thing that jumped out to me from going through your report. Like if I look at the top performers on your kind of qualification, discovery, demo, proposal, negotiation stage, they focus like far, far, probably a multiple of 6 or 8 based on the graph, on ROI at the qualification stage. And it looks like then on the average side, they lose deals in the negotiation stage, and that's where ROI finally comes up for them. So they total end of the spectrum. Is there anything you can comment on like what you're seeing with ROI in deals in your system?
Yeah, once again, once you start analyzing, you know, this is the first year we've had the opportunity to analyze that volume of sales calls. And it was really mind-blowing to see the difference in the way that the average performers versus the top performers are dealing with these customers. Now, I'm going to come back to the question on ROI because it's absolutely key. But just to understand what we're talking about here, when we're talking about measuring engagement or relationship strength, if I call you up and we spend half an hour together and I rock your world and give you loads of really good content and help you with your thinking, when I ask for my next call with you, you're going to be jumping on that. You're happy to spend that time with me. And therefore, our engagement score goes up because we're engaging more, okay? If when I get on a call with you, I go through I give you the patter, the standard pitch, and I'm just selling at you and just reading off my script, and I ask for my next call, you're not going to want to engage with me again, okay? And so the consistent difference between the top performers and the average performers, and really where we need to be spending a lot more of our energy actually training our teams on, is that they come across as expert advisors. They're there to support the customer. And frankly, as sellers, our limiting factor, our most precious asset is our time, as is our customers. And what we're there to do is make sure that every minute we spend with that customer, we're adding value. And if we do, they'll want to spend more time with us. And if we have more value in that session, they'll want to spend more time with us. And it's not a coincidence that the top performers are the ones building the strongest relationships, but it's not something you can force. They're building the strongest relationships because the customers want to spend that time with us. Because we're experts in our field, they've got a problem and they don't really know how to fix it. But when we come in and help them, when we talk about ROI in those early stages, what we're doing is actually helping the customer understand whether what we do or the problem that we solve is really a priority for them. is it really, you know, because inevitably they've got all sorts of competing priorities, but why should they focus on solving the problem that we're there to solve? If we can work together, the truth is that the person you're selling to is probably a C-level, and therefore they're a logical human being, as are you, and an expert in your field. And so you should be able to reach a consensus. It should be a consensus that, yes, let's spend more time together, because I genuinely think this is a priority for your business from what you've told me. It sounds like there's a timeline that you're working to and there's a budget available. Okay, I'm willing to invest my time in this process if you are as well. And then all of a sudden, you've dealt with the ROI question up front. And in fact, what it does is it speeds up the sales process because the customer now has bought into the fact that there is a return on investment. And it's the same with dealing with the economic buyer. The average performers usually only engage with the economic buyer at the point where they're presenting back the solution, while the top performers are engaging much, much earlier with those economic buyers and really getting them bought into this investment of time and energy that both sides are willing to commit to try and reach a positive outcome.
Interesting. That's great context. And it sounds like one nuance there, though, is in the relationship building, you can't just show up with a calculator. You kind of have to be a trusted advisor, an expert, and add value as part of that conversation.
You can't gamify the engagement score. I could send you 1,000 emails, but it's not going to change the engagement score unless you respond. And obviously a call, which is worth more than an email. So having that activity going on and the velocity of that activity coming together is what drives the engagement score.
That's great. And then there's just like a few other things from the report I wanted to cover. One thing that jumped out was how powerful partner referrals and the partner channel is. Like just about 10% of pipeline, then 30% of revenue, and it had a 3.8x velocity. Like, are there anything you can expound on there, like what you're seeing people succeed with partner channels? Why aren't they doing more of it, right? If it's 3.8x better, anything there?
Yeah, I think that first of all, let's recognize, and once again, what the top performers are very good at recognizing is that not all leads are equal. And really being choosy about which leads they invest their time and energy in is absolutely key. The beauty of leads that come in through a partner is that they're already qualified. And the partner is probably the expert advisor, the change agent within the customer. And actually, they're in the room when you leave. And so if they're the ones recommending you and have brought you into the deal, then obviously there's a much higher chance of you winning. And again, the top performers are building those relationships with the partners so that they're the first person they pick up the phone to. So again, not all leads are equal. There's a lot more data on this in the report. And we invest a lot of time and energy in all sorts of sources. And again, what we saw at the end of last year is more and more opportunities becoming available. But that doesn't mean that more and more are closing. We need to get cleverer. We need to be ruthless in the way that we pick which opportunities we're going to spend time on and jumping on the opportunities that are hot. And the top performers seem to be able to smell that out very quickly.
Interesting. And, you know, are there any other takeaways from that chart? It, you know, for everyone listening, they cover pipeline versus revenue for organic inbound, paid, partner, outbound, and events. And then they even cover the velocity, which is a very important metric in the report.
Well, what was shocking is that only 12% of the businesses that we analyzed really had a partner channel in the first place. And so it's not the easiest channel to activate. I know, for example, in our partner, we now generate over a third of our new business revenue through partners. But it took us probably close to 2 years for that channel to really start delivering. And there was a lot of mistakes we made along that way. You know, becoming an ancillary separate thing for partners doesn't really work. So for us, we had to give partners a really compelling proposition. And so one of the things I talked about earlier, the way we fix the dirty data and then deliver an insight report for the customers, we allow the partners to deliver those insight reports to their customer. And it gives us a really good opportunity to showcase what we do. And it allows the partner to show the customer a benchmark of kind of where they're at and what problems need to be fixed. So that's what worked for our in our world. But, you know, trying to activate that partner community, working out what works does take time. And also don't put your, you know, failed AEs into the partner community. You want people that are senior and strategic. You know, partnerships is a strategic part of the business. Sales in general tends to be very, very short-term focused, very much on the next opportunity, which is exactly what salespeople need to be. But the partnership side of the business needs a very different resource. It's about building trust. It's about working through the business cases with the partners so that you become effectively a piece of their business.
And then transitioning a little bit outside of the report, but you know, why it was so popular and why it's so topical is you know, from my vantage point, you could believe that forecasting has gotten harder. Like if you look at the miss quota, and then a lot of these layoffs too strike you as like, you know, this is only a byproduct of really, really missing your plan. And so at a high level, has forecasting gotten tougher in the B2B SaaS?
It's a big question. I think the answer is that the answer is probably the opposite. I think if you're doing it, I'll tell you what we're seeing is there is a widening gap between those that understand that they need to be a lot more data driven and are implementing systems and processes to get under the skin of the DNA of what good looks like. Because if you understand all of the signals around your business that are influencing revenue, then by definition, you plug those into your forecasting systems and it should spit out what number you're going to hit. Now, interestingly, I'll give you a little anecdote here. So our forecasting tools are all delivered inside Salesforce or inside HubSpot. Now, just trying to make the user experience as easy as possible. Now, as you can tell by everything that we do, you know, step one, you know, automate the capture of the contacts and the activity so the reps don't have to do any admin. Step two, you use the call AI to pre-populate the med pick and pick out all of the objections, right? There's a theme here. We're trying to take away the burden of the admin for the reps and actually improve the quality of the data so it's a lot more consistent for our reporting and insights. The challenge that we're seeing is that when we first launched this product to the market, we didn't have the ability for the reps to put in their commits and upside. So we just leaned in on the AI, right? So we're data geeks. So, you know, why would we make the rep having to put in their upside and their commits manually, right? We're analyzing the last year's worth of traffic. Well, no, we know what good looks like. We had to retrospectively put in the ability for the reps to put in their best case commits and upside into the product because people were demanding it because that's what they were used to using. But every single time we know that the AI always hits the number a whole lot closer than the reps do themselves. And what tends to happen over time is people just get a lot closer to the predictive number that we're proposing because we can see all the signals, you know, and some reps like to sandbag, others like to be overly optimistic. We don't care either way, right? As long as we've got enough historical data to analyze, we'll tell you what number you're going to hit based on the momentum and the activity and the multi-threading and the engagement. And maybe you've got free trial data on how many times people are pushing certain buttons and, right? The more data we've got visibility over, the more accurate that the forecasting can be. So there's no reason for the forecast to be inaccurate. There's always anomalies, right? You know, the first 3 months of COVID, sure, the numbers were wrong, okay, but that's fine. But as a general rule, the data will tell us what number you're likely to hit. And so you've got a widening gap between those that are adopting this new approach that recognize that sales isn't some black art that we can't understand, that it isn't data driven, and they're just trying to get under the skin of the data points they need to be able to forecast more accurately, and others that still believe it's this black art and, you know, everything runs off of people's notepads and just put your arm around the sales rep and they'll tell you what number they're going to hit and it'll all be fine, right? And if you're in camp B, you can guarantee you've got competitors that are in camp A, and they will continue to accelerate away from you if you don't step up and become more data-driven in the way you operate.
Fascinating. And let's just say you're a new leader, right? Perhaps someone badly missed their forecast, or you're just in a state of transition. What tactically should they do, or timelines they should expect to become data-driven and have some of this tooling in place and get themselves to this level you're talking about?
As I said before, step one is fix the data. You cannot be data-driven if your historical data is incomplete, inconsistent, out of date. So the first thing we need to do is fix that dirty data. And we're not the only player in the park that does it, but you need to put in a system where the reps are no longer responsible for their own admin. Because if you're still relying on humans logging data, in particular sales humans, we know that their strength is not necessarily admin. So we have to take away that burden. And if you can, go back a year through the historical data and fix it. The good news is you've got the information within your business. It's either in your mailboxes, it's in your calendars, it's in your call recording systems, or it's inside Salesforce or HubSpot as your CRM, whatever you're using. So fix the dirty data, step one. Step two, go through that data and find the insights. Again, we're not the only player in the park, but our engine will spit out a whole host of insights telling you, all the way down to individual leaderboards for the reps, telling you what their conversion rates are at every stage of the sales cycle, you know, how many days they spend in stage when they win versus when they lose, what's the impact of slippage on win rates, does it matter where the opportunity has been sourced from. You know, all of these different signals influence the outcomes. And so try and build your benchmarks, understand what good looks like, and then use those benchmarks to identify risk in the live pipeline. And that way it becomes a whole lot easier. And when the reps start seeing this data in picture format, their response consistently is, I kind of knew that anyway, and now I've seen it, I'm going to work harder on that, right? So, you know, we went into a customer the other day, their average level of engagement on opportunity was 67. It's always out of 100, right? But we showed them that when their engagement levels were above 80, their win rates were 6 times higher. And so all of a sudden, once we showed them that data in a nice picture, 3 months later, the average level of engagement on opportunities, 83, right? Same with how multi-threaded they were. On average, they had 3 stakeholders involved in the sales process. But guess what? They won twice as much when they had 6 or more. 3 months later, their average number of stakeholders involved in the sales process, 6, right? Why? Because once you show it to them in such an easy to understand, you know, black and white picture format, the drive to win gets them to do what you want them to do, right? And it's a whole lot easier teaching reps what good looks like and helping them with objection handling than it is trying to get them, whipping them into shape doing their own admin, right? So let's stop trying to get salespeople putting square pegs in round holes and actually focus on helping the salespeople to sell better, become the expert advisors in the room, help them build those strong relationships with the prospects that they're engaging with, and making sure that they're engaging with the right personas at the right time.
Interesting. Like this has been fascinating. And I imagine there's some folks who are listening to this and kind of want to learn more about EBSTA. Like, what's your ideal customer profile? Like, who do you work best with? Anything of that nature?
So all of our customers are B2B because we very much live in the world of helping businesses where relationships drive revenue. And that's not always the case in B2C. So all of our customers are B2B. You have to be using either HubSpot or Salesforce as your CRM, the only two systems we plug into. And then really, if you've got a sales team of kind of 5 or more, you can use our product. If you're a HubSpot customer with a small sales team, you can kick off a free trial. If you just go to EBSTA.com, there's a Get Started Now button and you get a 2-week free trial. If you're a Salesforce customer, it's a little bit more in depth, but we do a lot more with the data for Salesforce customers. So again, reach out, either download our report. And if one of our sales team don't reach out to you, I want to know about it. Or reach out to me on LinkedIn if you just want to have a chat and talk about where your numbers are and how they compare to the rest of the market. Our average customers are usually somewhere between kind of 20 sales reps and 250 sales reps. That's kind of where we live. We've got a number of customers that are a little bit smaller than that are going on their growth journey. And we have, you know, a handful of customers that are a lot bigger than that. But those tend to be our kind of our areas. And we're in all sorts of markets, not just B2B SaaS. We've got customers in oil and gas, in infrastructure, logistics, consulting. We've got all sorts of industries that anywhere where relationships are key to the revenue line, we find we've got a really good fit.
That's fascinating. Well, look, we'll include, you know, the report in the show notes, your LinkedIn, some other EBSTA materials in there, because I think I highly, highly recommend this report again. And hopefully it's a good first point of exposure to everything Guy and his team are up to. Look, Guy, this has been a phenomenal episode. Really appreciate you making the time for us. And thank you again.
Thanks for having me, Matt.